Suddenly, a contraction hits her. The hot springs and the walk home have done what they were supposed to do. She clutches her stomach and takes a few deep breaths, with a quick glance at the man still lying motionless on the ground. "Oh, not now, little one, please, not now," she mumbles to herself. With some more deep breaths, the contraction subsides. She quickly takes in her surrounds, looking for something, someone. "Alligator! Alligator! Here, boy!" she whispers. She gives a little whistle, then swiftly turns back to the black man. No movement from him, thank goodness. She looks out through the gap in the thicket. Only the family knows this thoroughfare. But there is no movement. No faithful dog trotting home with his tail between his legs, hoping his master will not be too stern about his absence. The only thing coming is a storm. Dark clouds build in the distance. Molly attempts to call the dog again, frustrated now and through clenched teeth.
"Alligator, where are you, you bloody mongrel dog?"
There's a sound at the edge of the shanty. Molly turns with hope in her eyes, but it is short-lived on seeing who stands there.
"Been called so on many an occasion, missus. Sorry, I'm not the dog you require."
A swagman. He looks to be about 65 years old, give or take a few years either side, but fit and strong considering. He wears an old worn, dirty three-piece suit, giving the impression he might once have had money. But more than likely not. It's his boots that give him away. They are soleless. The laces circle under his feet and are tied across the top of the boots, trying to give himself some status with a pair of shoes. Molly takes in the swagman slowly, giving her mind time to settle, but her heart beats hard and fast in her chest, and in a split second she thinks, "What the hell is going on here? Were my past days of good luck an illusion? Oh, I'm no Christian, but dear Lord, or any greater power for that matter, if you're listening, I need your strength." She eyes her intruder. Well, the conscious one. "Bloody hell, two of the bastards to deal with, each as bad as the other." Molly knows the swagmen around these parts are not to be trusted. She's had her fair share of run-ins with these rogue sundowners and has run quite a few off her property. They come at sunset, trying not to hit the same property in succession, with desperate pleas for food and a bed, standing over the lady of the house. They know who has a husband and when he is away. They're not as stupid, senile, or caring as they make out. With her shotgun aimed straight at the swagman, Molly stands strong. The swaggy quickly turns his focus to the black on the ground, hoping to take the attention off himself.
"He dead, missus?"
"You will be if you don't state your business, sundowner." The swagman introduces himself with the tip of his hat.
"Thomas McNeely, m'lady."
He takes a flamboyant bow. "Ain't no lady, just a drover's wife. State your business," Molly snaps back. McNeely informs her that she might have scored herself a reward. Molly hasn't time for roundabout chit-chat and tells him so. The swaggy points to the Aboriginal man, still unconscious on the ground, and says,
"Felon on the run, missus. Murder. Murderer. Hey, on your doorstep."
He points to the black again, placing sole blame and with great conviction. Molly probes for more information. She needs to know the details for her safety.
"Murder? Who?"
Her voice rises an octave with curiosity. McNeely continues with grand theatrics now. He knows he has her attention.
"The whole district is on the lookout. Be crawling with troopers any minute now."
Molly's back straightens, her thoughts race, and for a split second she lets her guard down. The swaggy takes a step forward. Molly snaps back to her reality, raising her gun.
"Who was murdered?" "A white woman like you, on her own with the children. Mountain country."
McNeely delights in offering her this bit of information.
"Who?" "A Mrs. Ola Edwards and a wee ones. A week back now. Other side of the range. The hide of the murdering bastard. Such a prominent woman of the area."
Molly is taken aback.
Absent-mindedly, she lowers her gun, thinking about the tragedy. Oh, dear. Molly did not know Ula personally, but had asked for favours when food was scarce. It was Danny who did the inquiring. Any death is sad and horrific, especially murder, especially a mother and her children. Proof, Molly knows, that danger can be anywhere and everywhere, and with the drover, her husband, away. McNeely sees her distraction and dives into his best performance yet. Pointing and with a slight skip in his step, he prances around the black man on the ground.
Niggers! Savage bastards just like him might be him. Where's the collar?
Molly considers this and realizes that yes, this could very well be true. He does wear the collar. For a fleeting moment, she shows her vulnerability. McNeely grasps the moment, theatrically leaping into his epilogue.
Horrific. Rape. Strangulation. The boy is sodomized, and the girl drowned. Life escaping through sapphire blue eyes.
Molly is caught up in his performance, but her eyes narrow with caution. McNeely sees this and is quick to respond.
So I'm told. The lengths people go to for detail. Those wee children, I think of yours. The wee girl. So precious.
This last detail snaps Molly back to reality. What the hell was she thinking, letting her guard down? She can only blame her hormones. Standing here listening to a rogue talking shite. She steps closer, her grip firm on her shotgun.
What do you know of my children?
McNeely knows he has overstepped the mark and quickly goes into submission, backing away like the dog he is, tail between his legs, asking the good lady for forgiveness. But Molly steps up again.
My children! What do you know of my children?
McNeely, with his hat in his hands, tells Molly,
you know the swagman's trail. Round and round we go. Pass by here a few times. Keep my distance. Good dog you got there. Alligator, isn't it? Looked in, though. That's all. Truth, missus. I wouldn't trust you as far as I could spit. Get going. Food and a little warmth of a comfortable bed is what I'll be asking of you. If you head due west and walk half a day, you'll find a willing woman and a comfortable bed.
McNeely licks his lips.
Ain't got no coin to pay.
Molly cocks her gun. I'm sure you'll find a way. She doesn't falter in her defiance, but he is not moving either. Molly knows this game. She's played it before, and her poker face is strong.
My Joe be home soon.
She holds his stare, giving him a second to take this in.
Maybe you seen his flock, sheep, due back to graze further downriver along the low flats before taking them to the sale.
A glint of mischief sparkles in McNeely's eyes.
They're down and on their way.
He's got her there, even if it is the truth or a lie, and Molly is reminded this could, no, this will get dangerous. But as she contemplates her position, she's hit with another contraction. She grabs her stomach, doubling over in pain. Seizing on her vulnerability, the swaggy rips the shotgun from her hands.
Please, don't shoot! Oh, my children!
Suddenly, the black man jumps up, wielding Molly's axe, which has been hidden beneath him. Nursing his injury, exhausted and in pain, he swings it at the swaggy. Molly quickly gets out of the way, not sure who to run from. In her confusion, she trips and falls heavily on her stomach. She groans, overwhelmed with pain. The swaggy sidesteps just as the axe comes down, cutting deep into the chopping block. In the mayhem, McNeely drops the shotgun and it misfires, hitting no one. Molly manages to scramble after it, dragging herself across the ground. The black hits the swaggy with a backhander, knocking him a little senseless. He tries to pull the axe free as the swaggy comes at him, grabbing him from behind and plunging his fingers deep into the wound on the black man's lower back. The black man lets out a yell that could wake the dead and collapses from the pain, pulling the axe free as he falls. He lies on the ground in agony but still clutching the axe to his chest should the swaggy attempt to come at him.
Molly attempts to reload the shotgun but is hit with another contraction and can only focus on her deep breaths. She fails to reload, dropping the bullet. The rogue swagman runs off, knowing he's outnumbered. The black man sucks in deep breaths, trying to bring his pain under control. His wound has opened up and bleeds. Molly tries to get up, but a guttural groan escapes her. She's in labour, but something isn't right. The Aboriginal man sees her distress. He gets up, axe in hand, and staggers towards her. Molly stiffens with fright. She can't do a thing. Her body locks in spasm with fear and labour pains. Afraid, she cowers, throwing an arm over her head in a desperate attempt to protect herself.
My children, please!
I've never been so helpless in all my life, and I can't do a thing about it. My mind races, flashing images of my children as my womb tears with life trying to escape. And yet, my untimely death is here, now, before me. I'm simply wrung out. I shut my eyes and hope that it is swift. The black man stops, then turns and buries the axe back into the chopping block in a gesture meant to tell her he means no harm and has no intention of hurting her. Molly manages to stand, and then her water breaks. She lifts her skirt and sees a wet patch at her feet. She can't believe it. It wasn't supposed to happen like this. Another contraction. She can't help but push. She feels between her legs and is devastated. Oh no, foot. The black man steps attentively towards her, lowering his head, submitting. Another contraction rips through Molly's body, and through clenched teeth, she says,
"Go! Get!"
The black stranger does not move or look up, but offers his hand, a simple and kind gesture of help. Molly's mind races. Through her laboured breaths, she manages.
A white woman letting a black man touch her is bad enough, let alone deliver her baby.
In this moment of madness and mayhem, Molly goes with the only option she feels she has. She brings the shotgun up like a bat, swings it with all her might, and knocks him out cold. He drops with a thud. Chapter 13. Sergeant Nate Clintoff sighs to himself. Bloody hell. He looks utterly uncomfortable and out of place as he stands on the front lawn of the Edwards property with storm clouds building overhead. He pulls at the collar of his official sergeant's uniform, undoing the top button. Uptight and flustered, with his pith helmet tucked under his arm, he dabs at the sweat on his brow. Not because it is hot. Winter is coming to the mountain country, and there is already snow on the mountaintops. But because he is standing over the dead bodies of Mrs. Ulla Edwards and her three children, laid out in wooden caskets. In disbelief and truly saddened, he looks away. This is not the first job he thought he would be presiding over in Australia. He knew there would be a few rough nights to deal with at the Stanlow Inn when the big droves came through Everton or when the sales were on. But murder? An entire young family on the sleepy slopes of this quaint, quiet mountain country. When they offered Nate the position, they made it sound easy, painting a grand picture of Australian life in the snowy mountains of the Alpine country, the landscape picturesque and his duties light. A great place to raise a family, skiing in the winter months when things are quiet. When Nate said yes to the position, crimes of this kind were the furthest thing from his mind. But here he is, in the middle of a multiple murder investigation. And, to say the least, he's a little lost. He has no backup or official support on the ground bar one. His assistant, Trooper Spencer Leslie, age 35 and assigned to desk duties because his skills are not up to par, and it'll be days before reinforcements arrive. Coming to Australia, to the mountain country, was supposed to be a safe place for my son to grow up.
to fulfill the promise to my dear wife of more children, me not having to worry about her safety at home alone, poring over her notebook, lost in her writing for her women's journal. Angst over my young son playing outside in the fresh air, lost in his imagination. I picture Louise's beautiful smile, her contagious energy, as I look down at the lifeless woman at my feet, someone's wife and mother. And looking back at Frank Edwards, I see a man who is deeply hurting. I can't help but think, this could have been my family. On the veranda of the Edwards now boarded up home, Father McGinnis, a large, jolly 70-year-old, comforts Frank. Trooper Leslie, a small-framed man with glasses, Nate's hard-working, very studious and attentive assistant, stands with them, taking notes and drawing a detailed description from Frank's words. His nose is narrow. Spencer applies the note. Father McGinnis asks, "What are your intentions?" Frank clears his throat. "Melbourne. Nothing here for me now." "But this is your great-grandfather's property. Your grandfather Charles turned this place around. The town needs you." "Sorry, Father, but right now that is not my priority." Nate crouches down at Ula's open casket, rubbing at his temple. His nose twitches with the scent of death. He considers the smell, then shakes off the thought. Where does he begin? He's been thrown into the deep end here, all right. From behind him comes a voice. "If I may, sir, I'd say it'd be good to get going." It's the undertaker. 65 years old, very tall, very skinny, and looks like death warmed up himself. Nate takes no heed. He has a closer look at the bruising on the dead woman's neck. She's been strangled. Who could do such a thing? Nate notes that on the left side of her neck, the bruising is darker, indicating the hold was stronger on that side. The murderer, left-handed. Or perhaps an injury or a deformity to his right hand, making it weaker. He jots this down in his notebook. There on the page is the description of how the children were murdered and taken advantage of. Trooper Leslie joins his sergeant. He makes an adjustment to his drawing and stands dutifully waiting for further instruction. Finally, a curt Nate instructs, "Get these bodies onto the wagon." The undertaker eagerly strides over to help. He and the trooper start with the three children. They slide the caskets onto the tray of the flatback Larry, an open tray wagon pulled by four horses, then come back for Ula. The undertaker secures the lid and inquires as to the whereabouts of Sergeant Klintoff's wife. Nate is taken aback by the question. The undertaker nods towards the horizon, where a ferocious storm has broken. Lightning cracks and races across the sky, electrifying the air. Nate hasn't seen a storm like this before. It rages in the distance. He watches, captivated by its beauty and harshness and the velocity of its build. Is this a sign of life to come?
"Hitting the edge of town pretty hard,"
the undertaker comments, interrupting Nate's thoughts. His fascination gives way to worry. Louisa and Samuel are home alone. Louisa Klintoff swings a wet blanket at the flames eating at the base of a dead tree in the back corner of her property. The lightning strikes Nate has witnessed across the range have ignited the tree. The rain buckets down around her, and her backyard is looking like a river. She struggles to lift the weight of the wet blanket, but manages to extinguish the last flame. Behind her, a spooked horse gallops in a holding yard, stopping short of smashing through the fence. Louisa is fatigued by her efforts containing the fire, and her words come back to haunt her. "I'm so looking forward to the challenges of life on the land." She dismisses the thought, gathers up her wet dress, puts on her determined face, and marches across the yard to the horse. She crawls through the fence, but gets caught up in it. Exasperated, she pulls at her snagged dress. It rips away, and she falls in the process into a big muddy puddle. "Oh dear, what a sight I must be," she thinks, as she wipes at the mud splashed on her face. She's not sure if she should laugh or cry. Picking herself up, she tries to get the horse back into the barn. She waves her arms up and down, making herself bigger. She recalls Nate saying something like a calming, "Whoa, whoa." So she mimics that and continues the flapping arm action. Miraculously, the horse settles. "Well, I'll be. It works," she says aloud. The horse is now staring down at her. She waves her arms and makes the sound again and manages to turn the horse. It gallops into the barn. With all her remaining strength, she pushes the double doors closed and secures the latch and leans against them, beat but proud of her efforts, wringing wet and exhausted but smiling a wide, satisfied grin. With another bolt of lightning and massive crack of thunder, she screams and races inside. Samuel stands at the back window laughing and clapping as his mother falls over in the same muddy puddle as she scrambles back through the fence. Defeated, she rolls over on her back, the cold rain hitting her face, and laughs and laughs. Life in Australia. A great story to write home to her parents about. And add to my journal. And with that, she is up and away to get on with it, slipping at least three more times before reaching her back door. The men have finished laying the Edwards caskets, together with those of the two elderly Chinese hired help, on the tray of the wagon, securing the pine coffins with rope. Nate and Spencer Leslie stand behind Frank Edwards, who stands alongside Father McGuinness as he conducts a prayer over the caskets. Frank's head is bowed, his shoulders slumped and shaking with emotion. The prayer is finished with the sign of the cross and the other men walk away, giving Frank a final moment alone with his deceased family. Nate pulls Trooper Leslie away to talk privately. "Mrs. Jo Johnson, further south? I'm worried about her. She's alone, vulnerable, and in a delicate condition." Father McGuinness can't help but overhear as he heads for the front of the undertaker's wagon. "Nothing delicate about our mountain women," the local men chuckle. "Beg your pardon, Father McGuinness?" Nate is curious. "Like I said the other night when you dropped her children off, Molly Johnson grew up out here. She knows the ways of these parts. Crack shot, too." "There is a murderer on the loose," Nate chides. Father McGuinness labours under his own weight as he climbs up into the wagon. Nate continues. "I wish for no further harm to any woman or child. Get home to your wife, Sergeant." They all look to the horizon, the rain falling and the lightning bouncing around the sky. "She's your priority tonight." Father McGuinness nods to the undertaker, who gathers up the reins. He looks back to Nate and adds, "And I'm not just talking about the storm." The undertaker snaps the reins and the horse and wagon slowly move off. Frank's wagon follows behind and Spencer Leslie sets off after it on foot. Nate calls after him. "Trooper Leslie?" Spencer reluctantly turns back to his commanding officer. "Quickest way to the Johnsons from here." Spencer quickly replies, his feet stumbling over rocks on the track. "Over that hill and down the range on the other side, sir, which I would not recommend. Not with a storm like that coming, sir. A local mountain man wouldn't do it." He salutes and runs after the wagons, jumping onto Frank's wagon for a ride back to town. Nate thinks on this. He looks towards the savage storm in the distance, knowing his wife and son are alone. He mounts his horse, but charges towards the hill Spencer pointed out. He gallops up and over the rise and down the other side, digging his heels into the horse's flanks, encouraging it to go faster. They approach a steep drop, but the horse won't go. It stops suddenly, and Nate almost falls off. The horse dances around, stepping high and away from the steep drop, refusing to go any further. Finally, Nate settles the horse, turning it away from the drop. He takes in the vastness of the land. He has seen nothing like it before. Its beauty, its complexity, and its danger, all laid out before him. A crash of thunder directly above startles the horse and man. Nate, defeated by nature, turns the horse for home and heads back up the incline, hoping his wife and son are inside, safe and sound. Chapter 14. Fat raindrops fall from the sky, hitting the black man in the face. His eyes flutter open. He lifts his head to look around, his vision blurred. There is something before him. From the blow to his head, through his daze and stupor, what he sees are obscure, fractured, impressionistic images. A gaping mouth, hands reaching, arching back, twisted body and panic-stricken eyes. Resting his head back down, he rubs where the shotgun connected. It hurts. He closes his eyes, trying to find his focus. Oh, what the bloody hell just happened? How long have I been out? Oh, thank the old people for the rain, which will wash away my tracks and scent. Oh, bloody hell, my head hurts. Opening his eyes, he finds his vision much clearer. He lifts his head again to see lying before him the white woman. Oh, the bitch that hit me. She's on the ground, in labour. Molly's screams are muffled to the Aboriginal man as he comes to his senses. He tries to shake out the ringing in his ears. Molly is in a great deal of pain. She holds her stomach. Oh my God, this pain! I haven't experienced anything like this. Oh, I'm dying. Through gritted teeth, she screams, "Help!" Groggily, the black man tries to get up. His vision swirls as he stands upright. Molly is desperate, her hands outstretched to him, grateful he has woken. But he could still kill her. He staggers towards her, coming around to stop at her feet, and takes in her situation. There between her legs, Molly's undergarments now removed, is a baby's leg and some of its lower body. This doesn't look good for either mother or child. He wipes at the rain dripping from his face, expressionless. He picks up the shotgun and the dropped bullet, wiping off the wet and mud from the shell. As he reloads the shotgun, he watches Molly convulsing. She pleads, "Please, don't shoot my children." Just as a contraction hits and the urge to push becomes too great, the rain hammers down. Early morning mist hovers over the land and a light frost covers the ground. There's an eerie stillness in the air. The white sallies and snow gums look like spirits caught in the landscape. Molly stands on her veranda, silent and still. Her cowls and dun aim straight at the black man who cowers in the far corner. She steps forward to stand over him. He stares up the barrel of her shotgun. Pale and clammy, her stern face peers down at him. He stares straight back at her, too afraid to move. His hands and shirt are covered in dry blood, Molly's blood. Her baby belly is gone. She shifts her weight, unsteady on her feet. There is a moment of tense stillness between them. Molly licks her dry lips to speak, her voice hoarse. "You saved my life." The black man exhales slowly, glad she has spoken and didn't decide to pull the trigger. The tension between them still hangs thick, each unsure of the other. "What were you intending to do with my axe?" The black man gives nothing away. "Well?" Nothing again. "You wear the collar." "I didn't do those things," the swaggy said. Molly is taken aback. He speaks perfect English. No Myall talk from him. Quizzically, she asks, "You schooled?" He just holds her stare, knowing others have lost their lives admitting to this. "A schooled black is a danger in itself," she states. Molly sways. She leans into the veranda post for support. Her questions come fast now. She wants to get to the bottom of why he is at her home, and then she needs him gone. He fires back his replies. Nothing to hide.
What were you intending to do with my axe?
Take the collar off. Try to.
He's facing towards my home.
Food.
Putting yourself in danger.
Need food, missus. Been running for days, carrying this wound.
This. He indicates the collar.
Heard you coming, lay down there, hoping you wouldn't shoot.
She pauses thoughtfully, then says, knowing I was alone.
Guilty. He looks down at his hands, covered in her dried blood. Molly's got him there. She looks out at the soft, muddy ground in her front yard. Tracks everywhere. His tracks, clearly showing yesterday's activities. They tell the story if you know how to read them, and Molly does. One of her gifts.
You need to go. Bury that little girl. Least I can do for you, missus.
You owe me nothing, she says defiantly. But he knows that helping to bury the baby girl is the proper thing for him to do.
Sorry for your loss, missus.
She looks him up and down, her lips pursed with distaste. It's the way of life out here. Everything's a gamble. She knows this too well, and the gamble includes him. Molly needs him to leave. The mountains are rife with trouble if what the swaggy said is true. And if he goes to town looking for that reward, I'm going to have troopers on my doorstep. And that is something I don't want or need. Especially now, she thinks.
The Aboriginal man hears her concern.
If he was a decent man, he would be.
This is what he is hoping. He needs time to rest and for his wound to heal. Sweat beads on her brow, and Molly pats at it. She is looking very unwell. She begins to sway, her breathing becoming uneasy.
Why should I trust you?
He looks at her sincerely and says,
You have no reason to, missus.
Another moment passes between them, Molly's uneasiness wavering a little. The black man has no choice but to offer up another option.
Help me with the collar and I'll be on my way.
Molly is desperately trying to keep her wits about her.
It's government property. You're theirs.
Never,
he snaps back with hatred in his tone. This puts Molly on guard.
You must have done something wrong to be wearing it.
My only crime, missus, is existing whilst black.
This sits heavy between them. Molly understands what he means. She has seen this sort of treatment growing up. The blacks around here are still blamed for everything. Not that there are many left. Most have been arrested and imprisoned or moved on, dispersed, as some would say. And at present, the whites have unofficial government permission to shoot any black on sight.
Please, missus, I mean you no harm.
He looks around the yard, searching urgently for another angle with which to gain time. He spots the wood heap in urgent need of maintenance.
I can fell a tree for you, stack the wood heap, level the ground there, though. Don't want any snakes getting in under.
Least of my worries, she says, dabbing at her brow again.
The black man looks desperately at her, knowing his fate is in her hands. Molly tries to keep herself together. Her vision is blurring and her breathing is shallow. Then she faints, landing at his feet. Chapter 15. Trooper Spencer Leslie tacks up to a notice board a stencil copy of the excellent drawing he's done from Frank Edwards' description of the Aboriginal man wanted for the murder of the Edwards family. It's an uncanny depiction of the black man taking shelter with Molly. Although Spencer has taken liberties, giving his subject the enraged eyes of a murderous savage. Sergeant Nate Clintoff sits perched on the corner of his desk, reading from a telegram. Bodies, stop. A trooper, native policeman, found, stop. 3 weeks ago, stop. North of Victorian border, stop. Moving native prisoner. Nate holds the telegram, appalled, tightening his fist around it. Black Tracker says prisoner killed them. He also said the prisoner is wounded, lower back, stabbed. He and Spencer look at the wanted poster of the murderous Black. Nate rubs at his temples, sighing with frustration. 8 people dead. What would make him come back up into the mountains? Probably a Wolgaloo or Narigo man, a local man. Nate remembers sitting out in Louise's garden, reading, finding some quiet time while Samuel has his mid-morning nap. Brief after brief, page after page, preparing for his work in Australia. Louisa was out this morning with her mother. He was quite intrigued with the local clans, tribes, and nearby nations' names, their boundaries and areas they considered sacred. Reminded him of the Scottish heritage practices. Then he found a statement in bold print that made his stomach churn. It is essential to know the Myalls if we are to disperse of them from the district. They do slow up progress and are a nuisance to new settlers and landholders and their livestock. All assistance warranted by settlers to help clear their way should be guaranteed. I'd advise a raiding party, sir, Spencer Leslie offers, cutting through Nate's thoughts. Nate looks at him appalled. If we don't, the locals will. They won't spare the gins or children. Innocent people will die. Blacks, sir. Good Lord, the attitudes here. There is much I need to learn. Nate swallows his displeasure. Trooper Leslie suggests they bring troopers and trackers from Jaron's outpost, the most southern outpost to the Victorian border. He goes to the wall map and circles the area. Nate follows the trajectory they would come. The squadron could pass through the Johnson's property. This is good, he thinks. As if reading his mind, Spencer says, Molly Johnson will be checked on, sir, but it will still be 2 days before they can get to her, and that's only if they leave the outpost immediately. He allows a moment of thought before he continues. Our responsibility to her welfare would then be over, sir. I'm hoping her husband will be home by then, Nate says. He looks to the northern border closest to the mountain range, remembering from his briefing, the blacks use the mountains to travel by. Spencer follows Nate's gaze. Knowing what he is thinking, he points out Milborough. It's the most northern outpost closest to the mountain range. Spencer knows the ways of the blacks well and the lie of the land. He has lived and worked in the area for some time. His father, a retired trooper, pulled strings to get his son the position he now holds. Spencer was bent on serving his country, but his poor physical coordination set him back. His clerical skills and outstanding drawing ability put him in good stead for a management position in the sleepy outpost of Crest Hill. Nate circles both the outposts, joining their trajectories to include the Circle Johnson property on the map. Get a telegram to both posts asking for their help with trooper support and an indication of when they think they might move out. If it's not immediately, you'll need to take a little ride, Trooper. Riding's not my strongest point, sir, Trooper Leslie replies with an embarrassed smile. It would have been in your brief, sir. Nate looks at him disapprovingly. Spencer tries to save face. And tonight, the town will be totally out of control, sir. You'll need me here. There's no denying that. Nate has been warned about the night after the big sale. He dismisses Spencer with an order to get copies of the drawing tacked up around town as soon as possible. He takes one himself and leaves. Nate walks down the main street of Everton. New construction lines the outer streets, which excites him. A new town. His town. He exchanges pleasantries with well-to-do high society outsiders, here for the sale and not enjoying the muddy puddles left from the earlier downpour. He stops to admire the newly erected town sign. Everton is burnt into the wood panel with June 1893 beneath it. From behind, a polished voice calls to him. Clintoff? Sergeant Nathaniel Clintoff? Nate turns to see across the street a very dignified gentleman with a cane. The gentleman waves him over. Nate obliges, stepping around a few big puddles as he skips across the way. The man holds out his hand and introduces himself.
Good afternoon. Judge Alfred Eisenmanger. District Court?
Nate realizes who this is immediately. He straightens up and takes the man's hand in a firm grasp.
Pleasure, Your Honor.
The judge, who is about 75 years old and a stern authoritarian, tips his hat.
If you make it past Sunday, I'll officially swear you in on Monday, he jokes, breaking the ice.
You may as well officially open the town too, Nate says, tongue in cheek, as this is also on the agenda.
Eisenmanger smiles.
If I get a good price for my sheep, I'll think about it.
They chuckle, sharing pleasantries. Then the judge takes a serious tone.
A little more than you bargained for, walking straight into a multiple murder investigation.
Not giving Nate time to respond, he continues.
We make an example of anyone who commits murder from here on in.
Nate nods, agreeing.
Understood, sir.
The judge clears his throat for the spiel to come.
The Edwards are a prominent family in the High Country. They've been here since the 1820s, our founding fathers. It's their money progressing Everton to further development.
He pauses for dramatic effect.
If they leave, they take their money with them, and the town will fold, and my retirement plan falls over. Find Mrs. Edwards and her children's killer, or killers. That should be your only concern at this time, Sergeant.
As we speak, sir, I'm waiting on word from outpost to the north and south for trooper support.
The judge nods his approval.
Welcome to Everton.
With that, he tips his hat and heads across the street.
Nate sighs, worry in his eyes, feeling yet further pressure to solve the Edwards murders.
His reputation and the future of the town weigh heavily on solving the crime and making an example of the murderer. He has to show he has control. Keen to look the part, he squares his shoulders and straightens his back, bringing his body to his full 6'4". His physique is impressive. He strides off down the street with determination in his step. Locals add the final touches to their stalls. Nate passes a small sideshow consisting of a merry-go-round, a knock-em-down stall, and a boxing tent. He sees a healthy and fit Aboriginal man, possibly one of the many Aboriginal boxers who work for the sideshows that travel the country. A way of working and escaping poverty on the outskirts of towns, displaced. The Aboriginal man places a big bass drum on the tent platform. This will be used to drum up business later, like a heartbeat, bump, 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 ringing out, echoing off the nearby ranges, calling all and sundry to take on the tent show fighters. A thought crosses Nate's mind.
I should come back to them. Ask a few questions. Show the poster at least.
A black fellow knows a black fellow. So I've read. But for now, he really needs to get to the stockyards to find Joe Johnson, Molly's husband. He takes a left turn, walking away from the main street and straight towards the gathered crowd. The holding yards have been renovated, with freshly erected wooden fence posts and rails where needed. A brand new sign above reads, "The Charles Edwards Sale Yards," in honour of Charles Edwards, who first came to the area in the 1820s, looking for better pastures to graze his sheep. As Nate gets closer, the stench of the livestock drifts on the slight breeze, and there is an energy in the air as well. Testosterone and plenty of it. Reaching the sale yards, Nate is taken aback by the sheer number of livestock and stockmen, businessmen and farmers perched on rails, looking down into the holding pens at their prospective buys. The auctioneers walk the top rails, giving information on the quality and breeds. The area is buzzing, filled with business, laughter, arguments, and bleating sheep. Stockmen of all ages and sizes place their saddle blankets and saddles on the fences to air. A few of them put out some feed, a few comb their horses down and check the hooves. Groups are standing around telling yarns from the drove they've just completed. The adventures in these yarns will carry and grow, becoming more daring over the next few days. A few men argue over money owed. Nate heads towards the first group of stockmen he comes across. They aren't as boisterous as the others. They stand at the side of the yards, filling a water trough for their horses. There are a couple of Aboriginal stockmen with them who might be able to help in identifying the black man on the poster.
"Morning, gentlemen. Nate Clintoff, Sergeant."
The stockman standing closest to Nate turns and offers his hand. He's the head stockman of his team, about 55 years in age.
"Bruce Longley."
They shake. Nate doesn't waste any time and gets straight to his point.
"I'm looking for Joe Johnson."
"Not in my team, Sergeant."
"Any of you know Joe Johnson?"
Bruce asks his crew. Two of the three stockmen look up from what they are doing, shaking their heads. Bruce throws a look at a shorter, smaller frame stockman, just a boy.
"Marty?"
Marty stands up from tying off his duffel bag.
"I think he's with Robert Parsons' crew. They've left already."
The slightly feminine, higher-pitched voice throws Nate. He looks closer and sees that Marty is in fact a woman in her early 40s. She offers him her hand.
"Martha Murray,
Marty preferred." Feeling slightly foolish, Nate takes her hand and they shake.
"They've left? Where to? Do you know?"
She smiles, pointing to the hotel across the way, the Stanlow Inn. They watch as three stockmen reach the establishment and are immediately surrounded by ladies of the night. They hang off the men like leeches, knowing all too well that this is their night to make some coin.
"The big bloke out front with the red beard, that's Robert Parson, and his little sidekick is John McFarlane. The other must be your Joe Johnson. Those three are pretty close."
The three men enter the inn swinging doors and disappear into a dingy smoke-filled room. Nate watches, knowing he won't be getting to them for a while at least. One of the Aboriginal stockmen says in language to Marty,
"Nurumbay Wajbala Balabala Yaraman."
That's Joe Johnson's horse. Heard the white man talking about it.
"Whoa.
Good." Marty nods in appreciation for the information.
"That's his horse."
She points to the agitated chestnut mare in the other yard.
"One of the boys here heard him talking about it."
The mare runs back and forth along the fence, looking out to the mountains. At freedom, perhaps. Bruce pipes up.
"She looks keen to get home."
Nate offers a lame smile. "I was hoping Joe Johnson was too."
"A man's got to have a fuck, a feed and a fight before facing the family."
Marty's language takes Nate by surprise. Bruce gives her a disapproving look, feigning bashfulness. Marty takes her husband's arm and says,
"Well, some do, my dear."
Bruce gives Nate some advice.
"If you want to get any sense out of them or want them to see reason, I'd wait a bit."
He quickly adds,
"It wasn't his family that was murdered, was it?"
Nate tells him it wasn't, but he's hoping Joe Johnson is heading home sooner rather than later. He adds, "I haven't been able to get away to see if his wife is all right. I'm especially worried for her being in the district where the murders took place. But at least Joe's in town and will head home eventually," he thinks. He takes the poster from his pocket and shows it to the two Aboriginal stockmen. They look at it closely, speaking softly to each other in language. Bruce interrupts them.
"Speak up, Jimmy James."
The stockman removes his hat to speak.
"Nothing, boss. Don't know him."
Nate takes the poster and places it back in his pocket as he contemplates his next move. Chapter 16. A large piece of medium rare steak sizzles beside Molly's bed. The plate rests on a homemade side table, steam rising off it. Molly stirs. Fractured, obscure images flash before her eyes, too confusing to make any clear sense. Is it the horror of yesterday, or something else driving these nightmares? Suddenly she springs awake and sits bolt upright. She looks around to get her bearings and sees her shotgun lying beside her on the bed. Where's the black man? What's he up to? She looks around and sees him sitting on the floor near the stove, eating, his back to her. The Aboriginal man has finished off the last morsels of his meal, sucking a small bone clean. He needed that. A look of satisfaction crosses his face as he pockets the bone. He feels the muzzle of the gun on his scalp and surrenders, raising his hands. Behind him stands Molly, her shotgun aimed at the back of his head. A thought crosses his mind.
If this is my last meal, it was bloody good.
Get up and get outside, Molly orders. He does as he is told. Outside, Molly holds the axe up high. The Aboriginal man's head is on the chopping block. She brings the axe down, bang, straight on the hinge of the man's collar. It falls away. With the iron collar in his hand, he springs up from his kneeling position before the chopping block, grateful. They hold each other's stare.
Thank you, missus,
he says, indicating the collar.
Thank you.
Molly looks at him wearily. She's not sure if she has done the right thing.
Blast it! Oh, what the hell have I done?
When he had the collar on, she had some control over him. This could mean trouble for her, but he's already had ample opportunity to kill her if he so desired. And if he's wearing the collar and anyone comes here, that collar will bring them both undone. Other than his injury, he's a fit, capable man, and she needs help. Molly hasn't been well, and with the trauma of the breech birth, Molly's not well, and there's only so much Danny will be able to do. Freeing him, she did owe the black man that for his trouble, helping with her stillborn baby girl, and essentially saving her life. He looks at her, questioning. Molly finds her strength and stands tall, bringing her shotgun up and across her body. All she really wants to do is go to bed for a few days. With her bravado returning comes her confirmation for his questioning eyes. One night, fell a tree, and you need to be gone.
Two. Full moon, then. Good to walk by.
Molly can't believe his audacity. Give you an inch and you'll take a bloody mile. She tries another tack. My husband be home soon.
And your children?
He innocently asks. This puts Molly on guard. She points her shotgun straight at him. What do you know of my children?
Notice the little stretcher beds along the wall, that's all.
They're none of your business. Silence between them, Molly holding her ground. Cross me and I'll kill you. Shoot you where you stand and bury you where you fall. He nods his understanding, believing she'll do just that. Bury that deep, she says, indicating the collar. They look at each other, knowing they are now in this together. Molly has damaged government property to release a prisoner. Best you stay out of sight. He nods, thankfully.
Yes, boss,
the black man replies, dropping his head in respect. Molly knows this action well, having seen it as a little girl. The blacks do it all the time. Doesn't mean much, because they can still be rogues. That's what Molly remembers. My husband's the boss. I'm just a drover's wife. Now get to burying that collar and dig in the grave. I'll go and say my goodbyes.
Good to do that, missus.
Molly ignores him and goes inside. As she steps across the threshold, her guard slips away and the agony on her face shows just how ill she really is.
Can I wash up before we bury the little one? I'd like to be respectful.
Molly turns back to him, angered by his talking. Is he stalling? Is he playing at something? She gives him a once over, then realizes he's covered in dry blood and mud. Another dead giveaway. She nods.
Be quick about it.
The Aboriginal man steps forward and offers his hand, saying,
Yarika, of the Gugiyimatar, adopted Narigo.
He attempts a smile. His teeth are perfect. Molly doesn't take his hand but says, Mrs. Joe Johnson. With her gun, she indicates for him to get around the back. She waits for him to disappear around the side of her shanty, then looks out to the front yard, at the ground, tracks everywhere in the soft mud, and exhales deeply. Nothing she can do about it now, too exhausted, and no dry dirt anyway to try and hide them with. She'll have to wait to cover them. She heads inside, vanishing into the darkness of the shanty, the sound of the latch locking. It's mid-afternoon. Shadows start to creep across the front yard. Molly's weathered homemade rocking chair gently rocks back and forth, with a slight wobble because of unevenness in one of the rails. She found the chair in parts during one of her lonely long walks. It must have fallen from someone's wagon. She carried the pieces home and set about putting it back together. Molly loves this chair, with all its imperfections. In it, she has rocked all her five children. Well, six, including this one. She quietly hums a sorrowful tune. It's the old lament her Da sang to her, black as the colour. The humming and creaking of her rocking chair become melodic. Molly's emotionless eyes stare off to nowhere. One worn hand softly taps the beat on the cloth bundle she has laid across her lap. Her swaddled dead baby girl. Yarika appears at the side of the shanty, his clothes freshly washed and partly dried. There is still evidence of blood stains or stains of some sort. He carries a little makeshift coffin. He is struck by the devastating sight of Molly sitting on her veranda, rocking with her newborn, the dead baby across her lap. There is a distance in Molly. There are no tears. Yarika is curious. He has gathered she is a hard woman and has lived a hard life, but this is her baby. He inches closer. Molly has not acknowledged him yet. He removes the little coffin lid. Mrs. Absent-mindedly, Molly turns and places the swaddled baby in the coffin without any further word. She turns away. Still no sign of emotion. Eventually, she speaks. I rode for 19 miles with that dead baby boy in my arms. He was 6 months old. Didn't see a soul. My cow died then. I was truly alone. Yarika looks to her, a little perplexed by the story she tells. But he dares not interrupt, sensing this is something she wants to share, perhaps. Joe. Gone. Queensland, Droven. 18 months. Just married. Me, 16 years old. Her breath catches. You right, missus? No response from Molly. Missus, shall I? He holds up the lid, asking whether he should close it over. Molly goes to him, clenches her fist, and places it gently on the baby's covered forehead. She blows through her fist. Yarika frowns with curiosity. He knows this action and what it means. How does she know this? So you were always with her, he says to her. A djinn showed me. She helped me bury my firstborn, Jack. She helped me bury my Da, too. Cried a river, she did, howling like the raging wind in a storm. It's not like she knew him. And then before she left, she did that to me too. I liked it. That's why I do it. I knew it must have meant something like that. Always with you. A comfortable silence sits between them for a moment, Molly and Yarika in close proximity to each other. He is aware of it, but doesn't want to disturb Molly and the moment she is in. He can feel something is going on for her at this time. She frightened me a little, but there was also comfort and beauty to the Waylon, Yarika informs her. Molly just stares at him, oblivious almost. Feeling uncomfortable with their closeness and her vagueness, he adds,
"Sounds like Ginny May."
He's quick to add,
"I know whose country this is and who can do business on it. She is our medicine woman and she spoke of you. Two births."
This gets Molly's attention. "Joe Jr. and Henry James," she says wistfully. Yerrika clears his throat, knowing what he is about to say will get a big reaction.
"And a no good man."
He braces himself to be chastised. He knows he's crossed the line with this assumption.
"I'll get my hat,"
she responds, then turns and heads inside, leaving Yerrika dumbfounded by her reaction. Yerrika hopes that what he has said won't come back to haunt him, jeopardizing his time here. He is intrigued with her story now.
Maybe she'll open up some more.
There is something about her, but he can't put his finger on it. It's been a long time since Ginny May told him that story, a story so dear to her that she would repeat it over and over whenever she had the chance.
Maybe it is this woman.
Yerrika hopes that after the burial, Molly will not tell him to go. He knows he needs a little more time to recuperate from his injury, which still pains him. He managed to make a medicine of herbs and moss to help it heal, but is depleted from weeks of walking over rough and dangerous terrain, exhausted by his ordeal with the law and the exertion of his escape. Yerrika is relieved that those days are behind him now. He's looking forward to a more restful and sound sleep tonight, his belly full. He knows there is plenty of meat here. As Yerrika waits, he thinks back to his first meeting with Ginny May. He had been walking for many days following the mountain ranges,